This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Each year, we're surprised by announcement that scientists have discovered a new plant or animal species seemingly living right under our noses. Well, in 2004, two Icelandic researchers announced that they'd found what they thought was a whole new ocean current. They called it the North Icelandic Jet, and they hypothesized that it supplied half of the deep, southerly flowing water that counterbalances the Gulf Stream. 4 years later, Dr. Bob Pickert, a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, set out to confirm the current's existence. He succeeded. In 2011, he again headed to the Denmark Strait, this time with the goal of pinning down the origin and true strength of the North Icelandic Jet. Dallas Murphy was aboard both the 2008 and 2011 cruises. He's the author of four novels and three nonfiction books about the ocean. The most recent is titled To the Denmark Strait, and it tells the story of the 2011 expedition to map the North Icelandic Jet. Bob Pickert and Dallas Murphy, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you very much.
What an incredible story. Now, this whole thing is set in this expansive ocean between Greenland and Iceland. And Dallas, you write that this is a landscape that is almost difficult to do justice to in words. But I'm going to ask you to try anyway. What does this part of the world, this is not a place that most of us get to see first person, what does it look like in that far in the North Atlantic?
I've been fortunate enough, basically through Bob, to see the coast of Greenland close aboard and the coast of Iceland. And I am concerned that words don't do this place justice. It's just fantastic environment. The east coast of Greenland is almost uninhabited, except for tiny settlements. And we saw some of the wildest country in the hemisphere. Glaciers snaking down through the mountains, down right down to salt water, and dark rock mountains that stretch off into the distance to the ice cap. Most of the time it's foggy. But we got extremely lucky on three occasions to get very, very close to the so-called Blossaville Coast, which is about 72 degrees north. And magnificent place. I've totally fallen under the spell of the Arctic.
Mm. Well, we do have some pictures on our website and a video from the cruise so people can take a look and see for themselves a little bit of what this looks like. Bob Pickert, tell me about this part of the ocean in oceanographic terms. The Denmark Strait is only about 600 miles wide, and yet you say it's one of the most important parts of the entire global ocean. Why?
Yeah, well, we call this a choke point. It's a narrow spot where a lot of water gets channeled through. And north of there, in the area that we call the Nordic Seas, which is between Greenland and Norway, that's a place where deep water is formed, deep, dense water is formed. And it's a very important part of what we call this global overturning circulation. And we need to know how this water is formed and where it goes.
So when you say the water is formed, that deep water is formed, I mean, the water is already there. So what do you mean by that?
Good question, Heather. So let's take a step back. You know, the sun heats the Earth unequally. It's hotter in the poles, hotter in the equator, colder in the poles.
Right.
And so to counteract that, both the atmosphere and the ocean transport heat towards the north. Okay, so now the ocean part of it, you know, you have the Gulf Stream. Everyone knows the Gulf Stream. It carries warm water. And the Gulf Stream eventually makes it up way up into high latitudes into this area, you know, between Greenland and Norway. And the atmosphere is very cold. So it cools off this water. It makes it very cold, very dense. And then that water sinks. And that's why we call it new water, okay? Because it's
just completely water, changes its identity.
It changes its identity. It sinks into the abyss, all right? And now it's newly arrived into the abyss. That's why we call it new water. And then it's got to go somewhere. And that's what we're trying to track, where this water goes and how it's formed.
So there's essentially a deep countercurrent for the Gulf Stream that's bringing this cold, deep water back toward the tropics.
Absolutely right.
At depth.
You have this warm water, which ultimately originates in the Gulf Stream. It eventually makes its way all the way up north. It gets cold, it sinks, and then it returns. All right. And then we have this ridge, you know, that's between Greenland and Scotland. All right. We call it the Greenland-Scotland Ridge. And it's
very
got little,
creative name.
Got little gaps in it. All right. And one of these gaps is between Iceland and Greenland. We call it the Denmark Strait. So it's a critical choke point where a lot of this dense water gets channeled through. All right, and then that dense water goes and fills up the whole rest of the world ocean. It eventually warms up and kind of rises, and that completes this loop that we call the overturning loop. And this overturning loop is vital to the climate of our planet.
Now, in 2004, two Icelandic researchers announced that they had found what they thought was a new current. And they had actually gotten the first evidence back in 1999. It took them a while to be confident enough to announce this. What was the evidence that they had for a new current?
Well, this is great. The Icelanders have been doing measurements up there for decades. You know, they take their ship out four times a year and they do all these measurements around their island. But essentially, they would be just measuring the temperature and the salinity, the characteristics of the water, and not really the velocity of the water, not the movement of the water. Okay. Mm-hmm. Only recently have we had the technology to be able to measure the velocity of the water from ships. So the first time that they took a vessel that had this capability and did their measurements, they discovered this current that they didn't realize was there, because it was really the first time that they could actually go out and measure it on the ship.
So they saw movement in the water that they didn't expect.
Well, you don't see the movement because this is way down deep, but you acoustically can detect the movement of the water from the ship. And that's how they discovered this current. And they were obviously stunned, and they had to go out several times and say, you know, is this really there? And that's how they discovered this current.
Now, Dallas, you write that physical oceanography, to your mind, requires an extent of creativity and imagination that other sciences maybe don't demand. And, you know, Bob just is saying you can't really see this happening. You're measuring it acoustically. You're measuring temperature and salinity and movement. Is that what you mean by the imagination necessary to be a physical oceanographer?
Yes, I think so. And if we put it in global terms, we need to imagine this ocean rich with currents flowing on the surface in the dark depths, some hot, some cold, moving around the world because the wind blows and the earth rotates and water has different densities. It's an astounding thing, which came as a complete surprise to me when I first started doing this kind of work. I've always been an ocean obsessed, but from a different standpoint, from kind of an aesthetic a romantic standpoint about adventure and sailboats and things. But this opened a new world for me and just thoroughly and deeply enhanced my appreciation and love, if I can say it, for the ocean. But it does require imagination because none of this can be seen. We need surrogate eyes in the form of the instrumentation Bob is talking about. Very esoteric instruments that came out of, basically out of Cold War technology and...
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
Now, if the discovery, you know, kind of let's go back to 2004, there's this announcement. The scientific community is reading it. If the announcement is right and there's a new current in the Denmark Strait, how important is that?
It's hugely important. As I said, this global overturning circulation sort of regulates our climate, okay? And people are worried about the integrity of this circulation now that the climate is warming, now that the atmosphere is warming. You know, the atmosphere warms, we get more rain, you know, more ice melt, and people have been talking about, oh, the circulation is going to be weakened or possibly even turned off, okay? But it all depends on where this water is being formed, okay? And if we don't even know where it's being formed, how can we say anything about how it's going to respond to climate change? You know, so the community up until that time thought that most of this dense water was coming along the coast of Greenland, you know, was being formed along the coast of Greenland, a little bit upstream of that. And if it's coming from a completely different place, well, then it's going to respond totally differently to the climate.
And given the politics around climate science at this point and just the pace of climate change at this point, I mean, this is a very timely discovery.
Absolutely, yes. But it also points out, you know, how little we really know about the system. You know, it's kind of hard to believe. You know, we've been studying this dense water flow and the flow through the gaps in this ridge I talked about for decades, you know, 50 years or more. And we thought we pretty much had it figured out at this point. And here the Icelanders go out and one day, hey, look, guys, here's a current we didn't know about. And look, it's actually maybe transporting half of the overflow water, you know, in its path.
So how does that get missed? I mean, how do we think we have the complete picture when, in fact, we're missing such a key part of it?
It gets missed because the ocean is so hard to measure, you know? Just think of how vast it is. And Dallas just talked about all the different pathways and circulations. And we're going out occasionally with ships and taking little snapshots and little glimpses here and there. How can you figure out this complex system by just a few different points all over the place? And that's why, you know, we still don't really know all the intricacies of what's going on, because it's just so difficult to measure.
So in 2008, you, Bob, went out to try to confirm this discovery. Was there reason to doubt it, or was this just due diligence that discoveries need to be repeated?
No, of course there's reason to doubt it. I mean, you know, the Icelanders went out a few times and they saw this current, okay? So maybe it was some type of a seasonal thing, you know, or maybe, you know, the atmosphere was acting in a way for that particular year, you know, that caused a temporary flow. We don't think it was tidal, but perhaps it was even tidal. So, yeah, there were lots of reasons to doubt, you know, how robust and in fact, the question is whether it was permanent or not. So, you know, the first thing that I wanted to do was go out and see, you know, is it really there? You know, we're going to really sample it very densely and determine if it's there, you know, to the best of our ability.
So how do you make that determination?
By taking lots of measurements. I just told a second ago how you know, you're taking these little pieces of information all over the place. So we were very, very, you know, dedicated in taking lots of measurements along this pathway and essentially just moving upstream. You know, we measured it here. Okay, let's move a little bit further upstream, measure it again, and just march our way upstream and see, you know, number one, is it there? And number two, where's it coming from?
So were you measuring essentially the same things that they had been, the temperature, the salinity, the movement?
That's
or were
right.
you actually doing additional measurements that would help in this?
We were measuring pretty much the same thing, except that we were doing it in great detail, in probably greater detail, you know, because it's very expensive to do this. You know, you need to have the ship. You need to have all the instrumentation. And so, you know, we really pulled out all the stops here.
So why you? Why did the Icelanders not go back out and do this work themselves?
Well, I was working with the Icelanders. So the way it happened was, you know, I, along with many other people, got very intrigued by their story. And so, you know, I approached them and I said, let's study this together. And they were very happy to collaborate, and as was I. And so we've been working together on this.
Now, Dallas, you were on that 2008 cruise. How did that come about? Was that the first time that you had gone to sea on a research expedition?
It wasn't the first time, but it was the first time I went as a writer. Hmm. I had written a book called To Follow the Water in 2006, I think that was published. And I had fallen in love with the science, and I'm always ready to go to sea. And I called Bob about some other kind of research, and he said, well, you're a writer, why don't you come along? And speaking for a moment, too, about this difficulty of measuring the ocean, that 2008 trip is legendary on the Nore, docked across the street, for the weather. It blew 65 knots sustained for, I think it was about 30 hours, with gusts into the 70s. So we're talking hurricane-force winds, which weren't terribly uncommon. It was October. And we were in the storm season, but the weather was just astounding. And we were blown out after that storm for a full week when it was blowing for, I think, 50 hours, well over 70 knots out in the ocean. And we were hiding in a fjord in North Norway where it was blowing 50 knots.
And yet you still somehow ended up falling in love with the Arctic.
Oh, yes, yes. I considered it a huge privilege to see the waves in that weather. One can go a whole lifetime and not see such a thing from the safety of a real ship. I wouldn't have wanted to have been in a sailboat or anything smaller in that weather. But it was magnificent, a real... It seems crazy to say, but I viewed it as a kind of privilege and gift of nature to be able to witness that weather. I'm sure it meant something different to Bob, whose valuable time was being
wasted.
What
does that do to your scientific expedition when you hit that kind of weather?
Yeah, it makes it very challenging. In fact, so I just told you a second ago how we were marching upstream to try to find where this thing was coming from, and we were making great progress, and we were getting to a crucial part where this ridge is located. And if we were able to determine if this current was present on the other side of the ridge, you know, it would be, you know, a huge discovery. We got right up to that ridge, and then this storm that Dallas just mentioned comes upon us, and you know it was a nasty one. So we had to go and hide in this fjord, and so while Dallas is sitting there going, "Oh, this is wonderful to experience this," myself and my colleagues are pacing back and forth, and the ship going, "Is this storm ever going to end so we can get back out there?" And as it turned out, we had just a little bit of time to get out there and take the last bit of measurements. So it's very frustrating when you're caught in weather like that.
And so, I neglected to tell Bob how excited I was about that. He didn't.
He could just see it on your face.
I just kind of went, you got other priorities.
He avoided us during that.
Right.
sounds strategic. Now, especially with the weather, it sounds like you probably didn't accomplish everything you wanted to on that 2008 cruise. Even if you had accomplished everything you wanted to, what was left to do after that? You're going back out in 2011. What was left still to find out?
A lot was left. Okay, we pretty much determined that current is there and it's extensive, but we still had no idea where it was coming from. And that's a huge question, you know, and that's what we had to go out and find. And so based on that 2008 data, I was able to write a proposal, you know, to get the funding to go out and take this next step, try to find out, you know, where the heck this thing is coming from.
All right, so that's what you set out to accomplish in your 2011 cruise, and we will hear more of that story after a short break. This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests this hour are author Dallas Murphy and oceanographer Dr. Bob Pickert. We're talking about their new book, To the Denmark Strait, about the discovery of an ocean current called the North Icelandic Jet. And I say this is both of your book because, Dallas, you are the author. It's your byline, but clearly this is very much a collaboration between the two of you. How has that collaboration evolved over time? I mean, you've been to sea multiple times together. Was there some sort of simpatico that you discovered that first time that has continued and evolved?
Yes, there was. And I came to it with no scientific background. I had done a fair bit of research for To Follow the Water, but my education had just begun. And our routine is that I write a daily journal or essay about anything I want to write about, and then submit it to Bob before I send anything out, which for him to vet. And the joke between us for a time was that I would write a declarative sentence, and then Bob would qualify all the verbs. Usually, mostly, we think sometimes, and it's become a joke. But our relationship is incredibly smooth. I mean, meeting Bob and doing this work has changed my life for the better. I, as I said, always ready to go to sea, but my education in oceanography, thanks to Bob, has been voluminous. I'm delighted with it.
Now, writing for a newspaper or a magazine is clearly very different than writing a book. But in the journalism world, submitting your story to one of your sources for vetting, that can be a really touchy subject.
It can. It can
indeed. Is that something that Bob suggested, or was that your idea?
I don't remember if Bob suggested it or it was just assumed that this need. We both hold strongly to the idea that the science comes first and that the accuracy of the science is extremely important. And some essays I submit to Bob, he returns to me and says, great work. And some he puts on the desk and they're just full of red marks. And I value that. And you're right, it is a very strange thing to submit to your source the work. But in this case, it's absolutely essential. The science has to be right. I feel like that's my contribution, is to tell the story of Bob's work and the science and life aboard the ship and the way these things intersect. That the interdependency of an oceanographic expedition. And I wouldn't even think of sending something out without having Bob vet it.
Now, Bob, not every scientist is as enthusiastic, I think, about outreach and education and incorporating that into your science. Not every scientist would necessarily, when they got a call from some author, say, hey, I've got a cruise. Why don't you come out with us? Why is that so important to you?
Oh, I want to inspire young people to get into science. I think that's hugely important. That happened to me when I was young. And I think it's our responsibility as scientists to communicate to the general public what we do. I mean, after all, you know, we get our money from government grants, you know, paid by tax dollars. So I think it's a responsibility for us to communicate properly to the public. And it's a win-win situation. You know, the public knows more what we're doing, and they'll get more enthusiastic about it as well. So I feel it's my responsibility. And in particular, in addition to what Dallas does, or part of what Dallas does, is we try to communicate to younger people. We have schools involved, for instance, in all of our programs.
Now, Dallas, this book reads a bit like a mystery in places. And even in the title, you say chasing a mysterious current. And in the introduction to the book, you write about how the 2011 cruise had an inherent drama that most oceanographic cruises do not. What made this particular cruise so dramatic?
Yes, oceanography isn't inherently dramatic because the material, the data has to go home and be parsed and analyzed. And this often takes a year and more before the scientist publishes his or her findings. But in this case, Bob had a hypothesis to test. He had an idea about what caused this current. And by the end of the cruise, if he would find where the current started, where the current was, and where the current was not, he would either affirm his hypothesis or find out that he had been totally wrong. And at one time, he said, I could be completely wrong about this. And we thought, okay, well, here's the hypothesis in the language accessible to the public. And that was early in the cruise. As the cruise progressed, there was that real question of he could have been wrong. And he said freely that he might well be wrong. He had to find where the current began and ended. Unlike most currents, this current begins and ends in a particular place. Most are arcs of a circle, sometimes global circles. But in this case, after doing all these intensive picket fence style measurements across the current, he determined that yes, indeed, it did begin and end here on the slope, the continental slope of Iceland. And it was kind of exciting. I felt sort of like celebrating when the data was in and here was his...
Was there a celebration? Would you have been very disappointed if your idea had ended up to be wrong? Or would that just be, that's the answer and we keep going about our business?
I was definitely excited to see the measurements come in and see that it looked like we were, you know, on track with our hypothesis. But, you know, I don't think I would have been too disappointed. It just would have raised another question. You know, I mean, the ocean's this complex, and every time you think you know what's going on you have a strategy and I'm going to go test this, so many times you're thrown for a loop. And that's part of the fun.
Now, I mean, you've been talking about how exciting and how important this discovery would be. In some ways, it feels like the pace of things should almost have moved more quickly. You want to kind of read, okay, well, in 99, they got the first hint, and in 2000, they confirmed it, and in 2001, we got the second confirmation, you know, that this was just moving rapid fire. But we're talking about 1999, 2004, 2008, 2011. There's 3, 4, 5 years between these cruises. Is that just the necessary analysis time between cruises, or why has it taken this long?
That's the nature of oceanography. It, like I said, it's so difficult to get out there and funding is hard to get. So you just have to take, and sometimes essentially baby steps to work your way towards, you know, an ultimate discovery or ultimate, you know, understanding. So it's kind of funny to hear you say, oh, it took so long. In some ways, I think it was pretty quick the way it all evolved, you know.
And are you... In between those cruises, is this really what you're dedicating most of your time to? Is it 2 or 3 years of really just looking at the North Icelandic jet? Or are you kind of wandering off and doing other projects as well and you've got to come back to it and kind of re-find that enthusiasm, go out and
you have to multitask. I mean, you can't dedicate all your time on one project. I mean, everyone multitasks, right? So it, in my case, you know, I'll have 3, 4, 5 projects going on at the same time. So I have to work my way through these. But of course, this particular project was so compelling and so exciting. I definitely spent a lot of my time, you know, in between the cruises, you know, working on the data that we had, talking to my Icelandic colleagues, talking to my numerical modeling colleagues to try to, you know, further the story.
Now, clearly, others found this cruise exciting and this whole story exciting as well. I mean, this was an incredibly well-documented for the public cruise. There were multiple photographers on board. There was a graduate student, Ben Harden, who was doing video. You were essentially journaling or almost blogging about it as you went. How different was the atmosphere on board this cruise, both from your perspective, Dallas, as a writer who'd been out once before and now you've got this whole crew? How different was it to be out with all of these different people working on documenting the cruise?
That's one of the fascinating things about this study. Physical oceanography is this, I think, unique combination of heavy industry, sophisticated science and really fine tolerance measurements. The salinity measurements Bob talked about, for instance, we're just talking about a few parts per thousand of salt. Mm-hmm. And that these instruments can glean this. And perhaps the other aspect we should mention is the cooperation between the ship, which in this case was the Nore, docked across the street from where we sit right now, and a brilliant, brilliant crew who, without whom none of this would be possible. Perhaps the day will come when instruments can do this without ships, robotic instruments or other sorts of free-floating instruments. But that day may be a while off. And right now, physical oceanography depends on the officers, the crew, and the technicians who are actually putting things in the water, taking them out, things that weigh a ton and a half while water's washing around their shins. You know, it's a remarkable, remarkable thing. Seldom seen by the public because it happens offshore aboard
small
ships.
And clearly they have to be paying attention to what they're doing.
Oh,
and they're
indeed
doing it very well. But mm-hmm. at the same time, it's also clear from this book that it's not all work and no play. I mean, there are excursions to go take photographs. You got to drive the boat.
I did. I'd like to just give a nod to Captain Kent Sheasley, an extraordinary guy who noticed my interest in his work and taught me how to drive the ship, how to stop it on station while they took measurements. And it was a kind of participatory journalism that I'm most, most fortunate to have. And I'm personally interested in all matters nautical anyway, but this was a delight and a treat to be able to do that, to be on this ship and watch this combination of roles seamlessly operate such that it made things possible. Bob is, of course, well aware of this. He constantly gives credit to the crew and to the HUI technicians, who I'm told are the best in the business.
You had a reason on this cruise to really value all of that expertise. You almost lost an instrument. I mean, an instrument stopped working and had to be repaired while out in the middle of the North Atlantic.
Absolutely, yeah. That was a pretty harrowing moment, actually. So we have this sophisticated instrumentation, and we always bring spares, duplicates. And in this case, our main instrument, we had two of them. And the primary one had some leakage and failed, so we immediately brought in the backup, and it wasn't working. And it's like, okay, what do we do now? Because we are just, you know, dead in the water, no pun intended, at that point, right? So we had to make phone calls, write email messages, and we actually had two additional instruments shipped up to Iceland, and we actually went and picked one up. But it turns out that we didn't have to in the end because we had this amazing technician on board who spent an all-nighter, you know, had the instrument hanging from the ceiling, amazing, you know, electronics, and he just fixed the thing. It was incredible.
Now, as we've already talked about, you're very enthusiastic about having journalists and educators on board as part of your research. Clearly, the captain of this cruise was very enthusiastic and was going along with any number of things to make this work. But was there ever a point, Bob, where it felt like maybe the writing of this book and the photography and the video was maybe a little too much of a distraction, that it was kind of taking over the actual science of the cruise?
I don't think I ever felt that it was taking over the actual science, but it was definitely challenging to have so many people on board doing that kind of thing. You know, I'm used to going out and, you know, spending 24 hours a day on the science. And now all of a sudden we had this whole other facet to it where we had to communicate with the public. And I told you we had some schools following as well. So there are times when, you know, I had to make decisions about where we were going to go. I had to, you know, look at the data that we've already collected. But no, I had to answer some questions for school kids, you know, or I had to go talk to the captain, or I had to, you know, work with Dallas on the latest essay. So you know, I'm not trying to give you the impression I wasn't happy to do that. That was fantastic, but it was a challenge and at times a bit frustrating, you know, to try to juggle so many things. But, you know, you see what happened in the end. I mean, it was well worth it. And of course, we're doing it again and we continue to do it again.
So spoiler alert for anyone planning to read the book and who does not already know the ending. But you went on this cruise despite the technical difficulties. You were able to accomplish your goal and confirm not only that this current exists, but that it starts, that it stops. Now that we have that information, how important is this?
Well, it just opens some more questions, okay? Because, you know, we had this hypothesis and the data that we collected is consistent with this hypothesis, but it's still pretty much a hypothesis. We need to take further measurements, okay? We need to get measurements through different times of the year. All right. We need to take measurements over multiple years because the climate's changing over multiple years. We have to go back to the computer and do more detailed simulations to really understand, you know, the physics behind this to make sure that our hypothesis is actually happening. So it was just almost the first step in a very long process to really understand this whole overturning circulation that we discovered.
And you alluded earlier to the importance of this ocean circulation in climate change and to some degree how little we know. Does this change any of our expectations with respect to climate change now that we have this information?
Perhaps it could. You know, the original idea about where this water was being formed was that it was being formed pretty close to the Greenland coast. And as I mentioned earlier, with climate change, you know, expecting more precipitation, more runoff, more ice melt, and that will impact the area near the coast. But now we're determining, or we think we know that, you know, much of this water is being formed north of Iceland away from the coast. So now all of a sudden, climate change is going to impact that part of the ocean a lot differently. So maybe this overturning circulation we're talking about is not quite so sensitive to climate change than was originally envisioned. That's still a question to be answered.
So clearly you've got your work cut out for you, and it sounds, Dallas, like you're going to be tagging along on more expeditions.
With delight. In May and June, we're doing a 42-day trip on the Coast Guard icebreaker Healy. When I say we, I mean Bob and me. And to look at plankton blooms in the Chukchi Sea. There's some evidence that plankton blooms are occurring beneath the ice, which might change the whole paradigm but anyway, I'm getting ahead of the story because we haven't done this trip yet. But that comes in May and June.
And might we expect to see a book about that?
We'll certainly see an extensive website and perhaps an article or two in the public press, magazines, that is.
Well, we will look forward to it. Dallas Murphy, Dr. Bob Pickert, thank you both.
Thank you
very much, Heather.
Dr. Bob Pickert is a senior scientist in physical oceanography at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Dallas Murphy is the author of a new book entitled To the Denmark Strait, Oceanographer's Search for Mysterious Current. It tells the story of a 2011 research cruise exploring the newly discovered North Icelandic jet. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk with graduate student Ben Harden about his video documentation of that expedition and other Arctic research. Stay with us. This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. We've heard this hour about oceanographer Bob Pickert's investigations of a recently discovered ocean current known as the North Icelandic Jet, and about author Dallas Murphy's book on the subject. It's titled To the Denmark Strait, Oceanographer's Search for Mysterious Current. That book comes with a DVD of videos produced by Ben Harden. Ben joins me now, and Ben, I owe you an apology. I misspoke a little earlier and said that you were a graduate student. You were a graduate student in 2011 when you went on that cruise. You have since earned your PhD and are now a postdoctoral scholar at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. So congratulations, and thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, before we get to the videos that you've produced, Dallas was talking a little bit about the inherent drama in this 2011 cruise, the fact that there was this very concrete answer that would be achieved by the end of the cruise. But clearly that's not the end of it. We're a couple years later, and you're actually now using some of the data from these cruises in your research. What are you trying to learn? What are you trying to get out of that data?
Okay, so I'm looking at the data that was taken from the moored instruments that were put in across the Denmark Strait.
What Dallas was calling the picket fence. Like, yeah, you guys basically strung instruments across the current.
Yeah, and they took measurements for an entire year. We actually went and picked them up again in 2012, got them back, processed the data, and what I'm trying to work out is what this current does throughout the whole year. Is it a consistent feature? I mean, we've been out there, you know, Bob's been out there on cruises and measured it, you know, in the summertime repeatedly and found it to be a consistent feature. But, you know, is it there in the winter? Is it there in the fall? Does it behave differently? Does it transport different kinds of water at different times of the year? That's really what I'm trying to kind of break down now using this year-long data set that we have.
And what is the larger importance of those answers when you have them?
Well, we need to know if this current is transporting this dense water back towards the Denmark Strait at all times in the year. I mean, this is a vital process for, you know, regulating our climate. The warm water from the tropics have to flow north to heat up the northern latitudes. And if they need to do that, then dense water needs to come back south in the ocean through the Denmark Strait, a large amount of it. So we need to understand if this current is able to transport that water throughout the entire year, or whether it's just a kind of intermittent feature that Bob has been lucky enough to find in recent studies, or whether it is consistent and we can start, you know, working out ways to incorporate this into climate models in order to understand how the world's going to change in the future.
So how did you first get interested in this kind of oceanographic research?
Kind of a convoluted route. I was doing a master's in pure physics. I was doing astrophysics and particle physics, and I was getting interested in climate change at the same time, and decided to move away when I was trying to think of what to do for my PhD, to move away from the kind of pure physics and think about things that were affecting climate change. And I got a PhD studying wind dynamics around Greenland at the University of East Anglia in the UK, and it was through that I went on this expedition in 2008 and met Bob and Dallas, and got interested in the impact of these winds, the very strong winds that Dallas was talking about in 2008,
right,
what impact they may be having on the ocean. And through that, I got talking to Bob about the way the winds impact the ocean, the way they drive currents around the northern latitudes, and was lucky enough to then be able to come here as a guest student and then onwards as a postdoc scholar to start investigating the ocean a little bit more than the atmosphere. It's such a new science, such a new field. There's so much to discover. That's the really inspiring thing for me.
Now, of course, when you were on the 2011 cruise, you were there actually as part of the outreach team, this team of journalists and yourself doing video and photos and writing about the cruise, not actually doing the research. How did you get into that role?
Well, It hinges on this 2008 trip with these very strong winds. I met Bob, who has been, you know, a great mentor to me scientifically and has, you know, progressed my science. And I met Dallas, who's been a great mentor for me in the kind of journalistic and documentary side of things. And I went out again with them in 2010 into the Arctic and asked this time to bring a video camera with me because I wanted to contribute. I wanted to be part of this. I've always been interested in video and documentary films.
Just as a hobby, do you have any, I guess, formal training in video production?
No. I've spoken to friends of mine who are documentary filmmakers. I got some tips. I borrowed a camera. I took it out on this 2010 trip, shot a few clips around the boat, posted it to the outreach website that we had. As a result of that, Bob seemed to be so enamored with what I'd done that he invited me on this 2011 trip to do a similar thing again. And I was very enthusiastic about doing that. I'm very keen to develop, you know, the communication side of my science portfolio. I think it's very important that young scientists think about doing those kind of things.
Now, you posted on the website kind of three categories of videos. There were what you called episodes, which are kind of you explaining aspects of the science, or, you know, a more fully produced video like you might expect. And then you also had some time-lapse footage and some montages. Were those essentially extra footage that you'd gathered with an episode in mind and then decided to do something else with? Or was there a purpose in mind with presenting this, you know, really purely visual? There's no talking about any science, just presenting the visuals of being near Greenland. What was there a purpose to that?
Yeah, I think mostly it was born out of the fact that I had this extra footage that I wanted to be able to kind of, you know, package some way. You know, sometimes you just don't need the words for these things, and it's just such a beautiful place to experience. And sometimes it's nice just to present those things as they are, just a visual experience without needing to narrate or tell people how to feel about it.
You've done this for a few cruises, and I think one of my favorite time lapses is just from the top of one of the research ships watching the progress through the ice and around the ice and trying to ice break and then backing out and going somewhere else. And
oh, it's just fascinating. It really is. Because when you're watching it in real time, you can see what the captain's doing. He's navigating through the weaker patches of the ice. But when you see it on those time lapses, you can see that when he hits a block of ice, it actually disturbs this ice, you know, hundreds of meters away. And it's all connected in this network of small little flows that all kind of join together. Yeah. And then you just saw on that particular one how the boat captain, you know, he parks up the vessel right on the edge of an ice floe when we're doing the measurements of the ocean, so that we're actually projecting the instruments going over the side from the ice by using a kind of blocker at the front of the boat. That's kind of shielding the boat.
So the boat is literally shielding from any ice that might come past and
exactly.
hit things otherwise.
It's incredible, incredible craft.
It is. You know, as we've talked about, the importance of the crew in actually being able to make this work possible. I mean, it's really quite difficult to just get what you need to done under the conditions that you find in the Arctic, whether it's the wind or the ice or the waves.
Oh, it's incredible. Like every time I go, I'm just amazed. The different crews, slightly different styles, but every single time it's just, we couldn't do any of the research that we do. We couldn't do any of a lot of the outreach that we do if it wasn't for the help that we get from the crew and the technicians aboard. You know, they make it all possible.
We talked, you know, Bob had talked a little bit about the needing to juggle the demands of the science team versus the outreach team. But you are actually, in your career, essentially kind of juggling those within yourself. How do you balance how much time and effort is going into the research side of things and how much time you're spending producing videos, producing radio stories? And does that feel like it's is that adding to your career, I guess, is kind of my question.
Certainly adding to the career. I think a lot of young scientists and older scientists are realizing now that you really need to have a strong communication portfolio. You really need to communicate your science effectively to the public, to policymakers. And also in doing that, I've found that I write better papers. I write, you know, better presentations in learning how to tell the stories that I tell to the general public. It improves my science. So I don't really see there as being a kind of necessary conflict between the two. In terms of juggling the time, yeah, that proves a little bit difficult at times. It takes a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm.
And the support of your advisors.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Bob has been an amazing support to allow me the amount of time that he's given me to do this work, and the support of Dallas as well in mentoring me in how to write better work as well is invaluable.
And some of the videos were actually a collaboration, I take it, between yourself and Dallas helping you with some of the writing, some of the scripting.
Yeah, the 2011 ones, as I said, I came onto that cruise, I was intending to take kind of short clip videos again, and Dallas said, no, let's try something a little bit more complete. Let's try, you know, telling some stories in here. And it was slightly surprising how I hadn't really thought of that necessarily myself. And you know, to have that kind of collaboration where he did a lot of the writing for those videos. We talked a lot about story and how I wanted to structure the videos. I did all the shooting and editing. You know, that was a really kind of amazing experience to start to realize that I could have the power to tell these stories. You know, I could actually, you know, start writing and start to, you know, take it on myself to tell the stories I wanted to tell about these research expeditions.
Do you ever feel like you're maybe almost too close to the research, that you need a little bit of perspective, that maybe Dallas as an author and not actively involved in this research maybe has some perspective to add in terms of what the stories are to tell and how they should be told?
Completely. I find myself in the great position of being close enough to the science that I know exactly what the science is, and therefore I'd never need to worry about getting, you know, I know the literature, I know the science that I'm trying to tell in the story, so I don't have to worry about that side of things. On the other side, yes, I would love to have the opportunity to be documenting science, which is a little outside of my, you know, comfort zone, a little bit more like I'm approaching it with fresh eyes, so I can see things that I may miss because I'm so involved in the science that I'm actually documenting now. So yeah, I can see that as being a benefit.
Is that a direction you're heading, trying to branch out and do more of this kind of video or radio work with other scientists?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I took the Transom Story workshop in the spring this year, which is the local radio workshop that's run in Woods Hole. And that was just an amazing experience to actually get out there and for the first time document things that weren't right in my comfort zone. I went up to Herring River in Wellfleet and spoke to the citizen scientists up there who were documenting the annual herring runs up there. And that was, you know, it was really a really eye opener on what it takes to tell a story that you don't know the background on, the amount of research you need to do, and the excitement that it can generate within you when you learn about something new and you then desperately have this story that you want to tell the world about. You know, I thought that was really eye-opening. And yes, in the future, I'd love to start branching out and documenting science. This May trip that Dallas talked about at the end of his segment, that's going to be mostly about sea ice and algae. So these are two things that I don't study. These are, you know, within the area of oceanography, but they're not things that are immediately within my field of expertise. So I'm really looking forward to getting stuck into that kind of, that kind of background research. And
so, I mean, you're going to be going on this cruise as well. Do you guys at this point have an outreach team, a set group of people that are going along on these cruises with Bob, that it's Dallas, it's you, or are the players kind of up in the air?
It tends to be a bit of a mixture. It's me and Dallas definitely at the core of it. I took on the role for the last one of outreach coordinator. I kind of, you know, got the team together and developed the website with the developer and all of those aspects. But yeah, we tend to, you know, bring along slightly different personnel each time, different expertise, different things that we want to have a go at. You know, if we want to make, you know, more videos or better videos, we brought on an assistant video producer for the last cruise. Always have a photographer, but that tends to change from cruise to cruise as well.
One of the things that you do with some of your videos that I really enjoy is just documenting what life at sea is like, and, you know, not necessarily or doing field work in some of your other videos, that not just talking about the research and the numbers and, you know, the ocean currents, but really talking about what people are doing on the boat and how you deal with sometimes some of the challenges of being on a boat.
Yeah, and I think it's very easy to document the science at sea in a kind of abstract way. These people are going to sea in a boat and they're going to measure the ocean without really thinking about what the practical considerations of that are. You know, you're going to be at sea for 30 days and, you know, somehow you're going to have to bring 30 days worth of food, and people are going to have to entertain themselves for 30 days and are going to have to sleep in potentially cramped conditions. There's all of these aspects and the kind of camaraderie and excitement involved in being on a ship that I think it's really important to document, because, you know, people just never get to see that world. They never get to experience, you know, this slightly different world.
Well, and to play the devil's advocate, why do you think it's important that people understand what it's like to do research at sea?
Well, because it's exciting to learn about new things. You know, these people are out there doing extremely different things to the average day person. And, you know, in the same way that I'm interested to hear about people who work in all kinds of different areas that I would never even have thought of as being something that people do. Yes, I can say that there's a certain amount of me wanting to kind of show people my world as well, telling the story of what the kind of thing that I experience. But I think it's universally appealing to understand what people are up to in the world.
Well, and I think we've seen that just in recent days with the story of the Russian icebreaker in the Antarctic that got stuck and had to be rescued, in the involvement of, you know, there was a Chinese boat that got involved and an Australian boat that got involved. And now I guess an American boat that's getting involved. And this has completely captivated the media and the public just as an adventure.
Right. Right, absolutely. And yeah, potentially, you know, diverting a little bit from the science of what they were doing, you know, in terms of making it the drama about the rescue and getting stuck. But certainly, you know, the question about, you know, are these people safe? Are they going to be fine if we didn't rescue them immediately? Is a question that you don't necessarily ask if you don't understand how people live on ships for very long periods of time.
Well, we look forward to seeing and hearing about the trip coming up in May. Ben Harden, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You can find Ben's video about the challenges of measuring ocean currents on our website, capeandislands.org. There's also a link to the expedition website and to the book, To the Denmark Strait. Until next week, this is Living Lab on the Point. Stay in touch with Living Lab Radio on Facebook or Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone. with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.